This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll have a look back at this week's special legislative session and a conversation with State Controller Ned Regan. This week, Governor Mario Cuomo exercised his constitutional powers and called the legislature back to Albany. When he did so, he was careful to point out that he had the power to do that, but that he was powerless to force them to act. As it turns out, there wasn't much action. Leslie Brokaw prepared this summary of the session.
The session certainly didn't end with a bang, but neither did it end with a whimper. Of the major bills that Governor Cuomo put on the agenda, only one was approved by both the chambers. The so-called extraordinary session was convened primarily to deal with the malpractice insurance issue, which Governor Cuomo, Assembly Leader Stanley Fink, and Republican Senate Leader Warren Anderson had failed to work out together. By bringing the legislature to Albany, Democrats had hoped to back the Republicans against the wall on the issue and get them to give in. But the Republicans were preparing to blame the governor and the other Democrats for the failure to really compromise, and the Senate in the end didn't give in to the Democrats' plan. At the week's end, most of the senators and assembly people had gone home, while the staffs of the governor and legislative leaders continued to try to pound out a solution to the rising insurance rates for physicians. The one bill that was passed was an anti-corporate takeover bill. Capital District Assemblyman Michael McNulty explains what it means.
Well, basically what it does is prevent what is commonly referred to as greenmail, which is a hostile takeover of a corporation in the state of New York with, in most cases, the resultant loss of jobs from the state. It basically tightens up the takeover procedure, and that is why it's generally supported by a huge majority in both houses, and some of the technical objections that the governor had to it previously have been removed, and I predict he's going to sign it this time.
On the issue of municipal liability insurance, for which communities across the state are having to pay higher and higher fees, the Senate and Assembly passed separate and different bills. That issue will sit until sometime in the next session, and probably until after a commission that the governor plans to appoint completes its evaluation of the problem. Toxic tort reform was left on the side by the Senate, which declined to bring the issue to the floor for a vote. Consumer groups have been warning that unless the state acts quickly to amend the statute of limitations, thousands of New Yorkers will be left out of the Johns Manville asbestos settlement. Toxic torts, however, is another issue that Senate Leader Anderson said will have to wait until the regular session. On the main problem of medical malpractice insurance, it seemed clear that a difference of philosophy continued to separate the two parties. The Republicans view the pain and suffering portions of awards as one of the primary reasons that rates have been rising so much over the past year. They want those awards capped. Governor Cuomo, however, remains unconvinced that capping the award that victims get is the way to go, and he reiterated that opinion after the Senate's vote.
I think on medical malpractice, they are prepared, the Republicans, to take care of their interests by saying to victims of malpractice, you're going to have to take less than you deserve. We'll make that judgment. We think that's good for society. I don't feel that way. The Democrats happen to agree with me. Stanley Fink certainly. Not prepared to make that judgment, okay? A conceptual difference of opinion.
The Senate's Deputy Majority Leader William Smith said after the Tuesday night votes on malpractice that the continued stalemate is a terrible disappointment to him and to the people of New York.
We just cannot continue on without addressing this problem, and the governor's position was just to delay it for another year and study it. Well, we've studied this issue, and we in the Senate put forward a program that I think made a lot of sense. It was said that it could have reduced the medical malpractice premiums by 40%, and it would have addressed it in the best way that anybody has suggested.
The governor's bill called for a continued freeze on physicians' premiums and said that doctors must buy claims made rather than occurrence policies. It set up a system of arbitration for disputes between malpractice victims and doctors practicing in health maintenance organizations, and called for tighter state control over negligent doctors. It did not address the amount of money that courts can award victims. While discussions among the staffs continued this week, Cuomo Press Secretary Martin Stedman said that he thought an agreement could be reached by early next week. I'm Leslie Brokaw in Albany.
Our regular contributor, Lee Meringoff, joins us now. He's the director of the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion and has some thoughts on the session as well.
With the calling into special session of the legislature this week, political observers in Albany have noted a subtle change in the tone of deliberations among the political leadership. What has been more open relations between Governor Cuomo and legislative leaders has now changed as political conflict and maneuvering have replaced negotiations and compromise as the basic mode of communication. Why the change? What impact is this likely to have on next year's elections? As the forces line up with the gubernatorial and state elections less than 1 year away, and the campaigns even closer, expect an increase in friction as Cuomo and the legislature, particularly in the Republican-controlled Senate, try to resolve differences over medical malpraxis, toxic torts, and the like. What is at stake is not only the outcome of these important issues, but the image these political leaders project to the electorate may impact upon the outcome of next year's election. At the moment, Governor Cuomo lacks serious opposition, and although that may change, the politicians seem to be skirmishing more over the possibility that the Democrats may try to gain control of the state Senate by riding in on Governor Cuomo's coattails next year. In an era of split-ticket voting, the coattails of popular incumbents have generally been short. Ronald Reagan in 1984, for example, did not really change the composition of the Congress despite his landslide victory nationwide. However, political observers have carefully noted the success of New Jersey legislators who rode in to victory last month on Governor Kane's coattails. Does this represent the beginning of a trend? Can New York Democrats reasonably expect to pick up seats in the state Senate if Cuomo runs strong statewide? These are the questions which next election campaign will have to answer. In the meantime, Albany politicians are not taking any chances. More skirmishes seem to be in the offing. This will test Governor Cuomo's executive talents and the skills of the legislators. The outcome of these battles may determine who the voters decide to return to Albany following the 1986 elections. In the meantime, for the Legislative Gazette, this is Lee Meringoff at the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion in Poughkeepsie.
Switching from legislative matters to politics, there was a major development this week. Former Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro announced that, contrary to speculation, she would not oppose Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato next year. Bill Gralty talked about it with New York Post Capitol Bureau Chief Fred Dicker.
Fred, what's your reading on what might have been some of her thinking behind making this decision?
Bill, I think it's fair to say that two major factors played the decisive role in her decision not to run again. Number one is the still continuing legal problems that she faces based on her apparent failure to fully make a complete financial disclosure to the House of Representatives as required by law and as revealed during her unsuccessful campaign for the vice presidency. There's still a Justice Department investigation going on, and it really does have the potential to embarrass her. Number two is D'Amato. He's a very powerful guy, very popular guy, and he appears to enjoy at least the nominal support of Mayor Ed Koch in the city. In addition, it's pretty clear, I think, up here in Albany, that Governor Cuomo was not enthusiastic about a Ferraro candidacy, and indeed, just a couple of days ago, he said that he really wouldn't have time to campaign for her or raise funds for her. So the climate in the state wasn't right for her either. Also, and, you know, as a bottom line, it looked, just following up on what I said earlier, it looked like she would probably lose. And you could make the strong case, Bill, that if she lost in her own home state, she would really be relegated to the political dustbin. Now, choosing not to run, she could at least still present herself as a national figure and get her name out there for the 88 national contest.
So you don't think it was any one of those, but more really a
combination of things. I don't think there's any question about that, Bill. Of course, you know, the interesting question now is who are the Democrats going to have to run against Al D'Amato? And at the moment, they don't have anybody good. For a while, it looked like Liz Holtzman was going to get in. Of course, Holtzman had run against D'Amato and almost beat him back in 1980. Now they're reduced to three names that are being tossed around. Arthur Levitt Jr. is the head of the American Stock Exchange and the son of the one-time very well-known state comptroller, John Dyson, a former power authority head, and a fellow named Mark Green, a New York City would-be politician who's run for some local and congressional offices without success. But it's not a star-studded cast right now.
Let me ask you this, and he'll never say it out loud, but is Governor Cuomo happy right now?
My guess would be yes, but you're right, he'll never say it out loud. I think he may be happy for a couple of reasons, complicated reasons, but I think he feels it'll make his race, which he expects to win big, a lot cleaner. It doesn't have the problem of a national figure contesting for the limelight, caught up in what many believe to be both her own personal scandal and some scandalous problems of her husband. And I think number two, it's going to make it clear when and if Cuomo wins a re-election next year, as I certainly think he will win, it'll make it clear that there's only one figure of national significance here in New York, and that's Mario Cuomo.
Frederick U. Dicker of the New York Post. Now let's turn our attention to next year. Before long, the legislature will return to Albany for the start of another regular session. Before long, Governor Cuomo will be presenting his budget proposals. And before long, State Comptroller Ned Regan will again be in the spotlight. The Republican money manager has become an important player in the budget process in recent years, and I talked with him about major budget matters. Controller, how are you?
I'm fine. Doing fine.
Ned, you are out there and interested in fiscal conservatism, it might be put.
That's right.
How is that being reflected?
Well, what we're trying to do now is to continue the deficit reduction that the state finally started after 25 years, that the state finally started last year. So I've been meeting with the governor and been writing to business leaders and to civic groups around the state to generate support for fiscal reduction, for deficit reduction and borrowing reduction to be in next year's budget.
Do you think the legislature has a stomach for doing that?
Yeah, they did it last year.
But only under intense pressure.
Well, that's what we're trying to generate again.
So you want all those businessmen and business types out there to and chambers of commerce to let their local assemblymen
exactly.
and senators know?
We've asked them to do all of that. We've written every civic and business organization in the state and asked them to do exactly that because it is a difficult item for the legislature. I think the governor is well on board now, but it is a difficult item for the legislature, so they need to see support.
Now, Ned, I know we've been over this ground before, but maybe some of our listeners don't remember. Remind me again, the Constitution of the State of New York says we can't have a deficit. We have to have a balanced budget, right?
Well, we do have a balanced budget for the first 2 weeks of the year. And then for 50 weeks, we have an imbalanced budget. Because what we do is go out and borrow $4 billion, by far the largest borrowing of any state in the nation, in fact, largest of the next 10 states put together. We go out and borrow to pay the bills for the last fiscal year. So in the second week of a new fiscal year, we borrow $4 billion to pay off bills that have been rolled over from the previous fiscal year. Then we gradually collect tax receipts over the year, and then on the last day of the fiscal year, pay off the borrowing. Then we enter the new fiscal year. For 2 weeks, we're in the black, and then soccer, we're back in the red again. So we are basically have an unbalanced budget 50 weeks out of 52 weeks, and it's that fact that I've been trying to cure in the last couple of years and have succeeded at least in blocking further extensions.
Well, a couple of things about that. Number one, the governor keeps saying he tried to cure it, and he did it. Do you have any problems with that?
No, not at all. and even of course, the problem is, Alan, is that the media will focus on the number one person no matter what. Even when the number one is trying to give the credit all over the place, the media will crop the picture, as the saying goes, focus the camera on the one person at the podium, and the audience many times never really knows who the supporting cast are. That's the way the media works, but as far as my role has been the aggressive one, couldn't have done it without the governor. It took 2 years. That's the problem. He didn't do it the first year, and he didn't do it the second year. In fact, the deficit grew considerably in those first 2 years. But finally, I was able to surround him with enough good sense, political strength, and logic that he did it. Then when he decided to do it, he went all the way, flat out, a complete commitment, and with good credit all around.
Now, Ned, I remember that press conference last year, and you guys took a chunk out of it, but you didn't go, when you say you went all the way, you didn't go all the way in terms of preventing this kind of thing from happening again. You went a long way towards
it. Well, we didn't, because the legislature balked at passing a constitutional amendment that would require, that would tie their hands in terms of new rollovers. They said that they needed, who knows, in a bad year, they needed flexibility. I'm not sure about that. At any rate, we weren't able to completely block future governors or future legislators from continuing this practice that that wrecked New York State. I mean, that it accounted for our low credit, it accounts for our high taxes, but we at least brought it to a halt.
Okay, now moving on, because I got a lot to ask you about Graham Rudman. Now that is the bill, of course, as our listeners know, that the Congress was debating, which
right.
comes up with the question of how to balance the budget by,
right.
God forbid, 1991.
That's right. They might balance it sooner than ours, so, but at any rate.
And as Governor Cuomo always says, between that time and now, a new pope may be born. I want to ask you about that. Apparently, one of the things that they'll cut back is aid to localities and aid to the states. What is that going to do to us from your position as the fiscal watchdog?
Well, let's separate the two. The first thing is that the Graham-Rudman bill will undoubtedly put so much pressure on cutting, and they've exempted Social Security, defense, and obviously interest payments, that there is no question that the domestic programs that aid the poor, the economic development, pork barrel, agriculture, on and on and on, the good and the bad, are going to come in, if this bill works, are going to come in for very deep cuts in the next 5 years.
Okay, I'd love to talk to you about that more, but let me get a hit on a couple of others. Our tax ratings. One night on another station, an AM station, I'm sitting there taking telephone calls on a call-in show, and some fella calls up and he says, how come, hey, Shartok, if you know so much, how come we have one of the worst credit ratings in the country still,
right.
after all this stuff? Is that still true?
Absolutely. The worst.
Mm-hmm.
The worst. 50 out of 50 states, our strong economy, our long-term credit rating,
right.
our strong economy, our the premier city of the world, the best now with the conversion, the best financial information system of any state in the world, the best accounting system that that the experts can devise, full disclosure. It all relates to one thing, and we talked about that 10 minutes ago,
right.
the state's deficit. So if we, well, I can tell you this, and you, if we could find that caller again, you could tell him this, that if we are able to get, if the governor puts $150 million in, the deficit comes down, there are no new rollovers, I can assure you and assure the person who called you that we will get a significant increase in our credit ratings.
Okay, now, if that's true, I want to ask you something that I argue about with the governor. Of course, I never win, but I do argue about
uh-huh.
it with him. And the question there is our bonding programs. He calls for a huge bond to build housing. He calls for an environmental bond.
Right.
Now, it seems to me that that's what got us into the trouble in the first place. We were out there doing a lot of bonding. This year we've done the Rebuild New York bond. Now, he is saying that these are not the same things as the old moral obligation bonds where the state had to fall into line that and pay off if UDC, for example, went broke. He says, now if you invest in those things, well, that's your chance. You took that chance. But you're the controller. You got to go out to the market.
Right.
You know very well that if somebody starts to default, a New York agency, we're going to end up having to stand behind them in order to maintain confidence in the overall state government.
That's right.
So the governor's wrong.
Well, that's a quantum leap of logic. Watchtower.
Well, you understand, Ned, no, follow me. I'm not trying to cause my usual problems here. But if the governor is saying, wait a second, we're not doing the old moral obligation. Somebody invests in a bond, in a New York State bond, and let's just say the worst thing happens and we go under. We don't have to pay off on that because
well,
there's no moral obligation.
There he's wrong. There he's wrong. We would have to stand behind it eventually, somehow, some way. The state would have to be involved. But let's break this apart a bit. The governor's right, basically, other than that point. We've come a long way since 1975, and we analyze now, in fact, I just completed it not 20 minutes ago, the final wrap-up of an analysis of where the state is in its long-term indebtedness as of March 31, 1985, after we looked at the five-year the capital plan,
right,
and the like. And I can assure you that we are in much better shape. We take a look than we've ever been before, maybe since the early 60s. We take a look at all of the liability. It's a total of about $29 billion. So we have gone through and analyzed everything. And the standard, there's only one standard. Is the taxpayer, state taxpayer, supporting that debt, or are they likely to support it?
Right.
If so, we put it in one column, and if not, like in Mac, we put it in the other. The first column, then, is taxpayer-supported debt, and it's about $8 billion. And then we analyze that in terms of the tax collections and personal income. And the ratios there are very strong. We are now approaching the median of other states. And therefore, if an environmental bond issue comes out, my judgment is, unless a lot of other things were to go wrong, that this state would be able to absorb that without having it affect the state's credit or lead to any of the problems that you've just discussed.
Now, okay, so,
all right?
So
that's the kind of thing we do.
So, Ned, that's good. Now, what you're telling me is, if I were a New York State resident, which I'm not, I could sleep better.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that thing, I think that's kind of history, but we're doing analysis now and checks and screens
right.
that no one else has ever done. And for instance, the governor might say, well, UDC is now self-supporting. Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you, we keep, regardless of whether or not the taxpayer wrote a check for it last year, we keep it in the column of taxpayer debt because, in my judgment, that is still shaky enough that I'm going to keep it there, even though we're not specifically writing a check each year. So we have really watched this, and we put everyone through a screen, and the debt situation is vastly improved. If we ever got those problems we got 10 years ago, I'm the whistleblower, and I think we could stop them.
State Controller Ned Regan. Now comes that part of the show, which is always most enjoyable to me, when I get a chance to speak with producer Bill Gralty. Bill, what really excited you about the news this week?
A lot of sound and a lot of fury, a lot of interesting things to watch going on down at the Capitol. In the end, that's pretty much all we come up with, though, is a lot of talk, a lot of claims and counterclaims, charges and countercharges. The Democrats charging the Republicans are holding up the show on malpractice and municipal liability and toxic torts and on down the list. The Republicans are saying the same thing about the Democrats. We're pretty much just where we were a week or 2 weeks ago, with the exception of passing the anti-corporate takeover bill, which makes it a little bit more difficult to raid a New York corporation. Mixed in all this, and I'm interested in your thoughts on it, the politics of it. I think the people have heard the facts such as they are often enough. Where do we stand politically? Is there a political winner and loser in all of this?
Well, to some degree, they all lost. The governor and both houses of the legislature, they showed that they weren't able, in terms of doing the people's business, to get together and do something what needed to be done, something that needed to be done in order to alleviate the situation. On the other hand, the fallout isn't that bad because they're out there polling, they're out there with their fingers up in the wind, and they're finding out that people just really don't care that much about the malpractice issue. It is very interesting on this corporate takeover. Talk about the politics there. I'm fairly well convinced that one of the reasons that Governor Cuomo vetoed that corporate takeover bill, months ago, was because he really was left out of those negotiations. He's been fairly open about that. And I think he taught them a little lesson. He said, you don't negotiate
with the fat cats on corporate takeover without bringing me in. And I think in a way he was wagging his finger both at Stanley Fink and Warren Anderson and say, at least this is going to be a tripartite process. You're not going to leave governors out and bring it to me as a fait accompli. And I think he sort of gave them a lesson. And anybody who listened to the Capital Connection this week heard a little bit of insight into that one. As for the Geraldine Ferraro affair, that is absolutely fascinating. Here is Mario Cuomo absolutely shooting signals at Ms. Ferraro, saying, stay out, stay out, stay out. On the other hand, because if she had come in and she had really given D'Amato a contest, it might have been very embarrassing, because here's this guy who's being considered as a presidential candidate. On the other hand, if he doesn't, but he needs D'Amato desperately as a line into the White House. He's been extremely helpful to this Democratic governor as a Republican with close ties to the President of the United States. He's delivered on deductibility of state and local taxes and that sort of thing. So, but here's the downside of that, Bill. Can you imagine if this potential Democratic nominee for the presidency was seen as helping the Republicans organized the United States Senate? That would have been bad. So her staying out, now they'll look around and they'll get some hapless soul.
As Fred pointed out a few minutes ago on the program, there are no, it's not a star-studded lineup by any means, those who are left to stand up against Alphonse D'Amato.
Although, you know, Bill, this is funny.
Are we going to get somebody out of the woodwork?
It could happen. Yeah. In other words, let me give you a name out of the hat. Andrew Stein, who has always shown a tremendous willingness to spend money on a campaign, some of it his father's on a campaign. He's extraordinarily attractive to the rank-and-file voter, despite the fact that an awful lot of politicians hate his guts in New York and have expressed that over the years. He comes up and he runs in a primary, let's say, and he wins. And then he spends all that money, and he's very photogenic, and he's extremely articulate, and he runs against D'Amato, who is none of those things, you know? Mm-hmm. And he wins. That could happen. And they could really be up the creek. So, in a way, if that kind of thing happened, they might really outfox themselves.
Do you see the possibility of another unknown, a minority other than a woman, a black candidate emerging, or a Hispanic candidate?
Well, now that's an interesting question, because it may well be that this is an opportunity, if you want to have a sacrificial person, to have somebody...
A la Jerry Ferraro as vice presidential candidate.
That's right. To have
to
somebody with high symbolism who you don't think is going to win, but it gives you an opportunity to show your Democratic ability to put a ticket together. It might well be that you have something there. That's our show for this week. Join us again next week for another look at state government and politics. Bill Gralty edits and produces this program. Leslie Brokaw is associate editor. Please address comments and questions to us at WAMC, Box 13,000, Albany, New York, 12212. I'm Alan Chartock.